Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. On this week's show, we're examining the writing life with one author reflecting on the novel that won her the Pulitzer Prize and another looking back over four decades of short fiction. Jennifer Egan came to a Guardian Live event to discuss her 2011 novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, and became involved in a wide-ranging conversation with her devoted fans about time, technology, and how the chronology of publication doesn't always reflect the order in which novels emerge from the writer's pen. But first, we hear from M. John Harrison, a writer who's been exploding the conventions of genre since the 1970s. He came into the studio with his latest collection of short fiction, You Should Come With Me Now, and began by reading one of the shorter pieces from the book. Just don't call it a fragment.
Cries. They start between 6 and 6.30 in the evening. They're usually distant. If they have a motive, it's internal and psychic, like the sounds of someone with a head wound. They're not rational, except in relation to themselves. At times, they seem to move closer, the way sounds do on a wind, especially in the night. For a moment, the listener is able to distinguish more than one voice, perhaps even differentiate male from female. There are qualities of both plaintiveness and aggression, but words are hard to make out. They reach a peak by 10 in the evening. By midnight, they've moved away for good, and the centre of the little town is dark and quiet.
You Should Come With Me Now collects together stories, short stories, and then little fragments, little flashes like that as well. How far back, what kind of period is this of your work? How far back do they stretch?
There are elements in both the longer stories and the flash fiction that go back as far as 1974.
Yeah, so it's a real kind of a work that's been building for a little while.
Yeah, I do a lot of note-making and a lot of collection of conversations and incidents and events which I keep in separate files under very simple concepts like character or inside or outside. And every so often I will troll through these because some other observation or note will give me an idea of a way to bring some of them together and make them into a story. And that, for me, with short stories, not so much novels, but definitely short stories, that's the game. The game
Absolutely.
Is to assemble them in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a kind of a large range here. There's a kind of strange invasion of the City of London. There's a restoration job up a tower in a church outside Halifax. And there's a few aliens, one or two, and a fleet of 787 Dreamliners all the way through here. But there's a real similarity of mood and tone that runs through much of this collection, like in Cries. I mean, it's deeply unsettling. Is that what you're aiming for, that mood?
Yes, deep unsettlement is, you know, certainly a target. Any of those words are fine, eerie, ontological. My aim from the start, again, particularly with these types of short stories, has been to unsettle the reader and attach that unsettlement to a politics, to an ideology.
Are you more interested in that effect, this kind of the qualities of plaintiveness and aggressiveness, you might almost say, than any kind of the usual kind of rewards of fiction?
Not entirely. I mean, I think that a piece of fiction has to work to work. That it has to have some, the reader needs some points of identification that they identify with, quote, story. So you have to provide that. And in stories like the one you mentioned about the church being rebuilt, that is an absolutely classical ghost story narrative. Technically, you could have read that in an M.I. James.
With the dream?
Yeah.
Going through the guy's mind and the...
Yeah. But also the disturbed place, the classic trope of the disturbed, you know, disturbed religious place. And all of that was tailored to move towards a typical ghost story ending without giving you the typical ghost story ending.
I mean, this is what I mean. There isn't a kind of reveal at the end as such, is there?
There is. I mean, in that particular story, there is a reveal, but even I am not entirely sure what's being revealed. Something very horrible has gone on there.
Something of exactly that really creeps everybody out.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's tempting to suggest that, like the voices in Cries, that the stories are, they've only got a kind of internal and psychic motive, or they're not rational except in relation to themselves, that the words or the meaning, if you like, is kind of hard to make out.
Yeah, and I would prefer it to be. I would like the reader to work a little.
Is that also why you got elements of the strange mixed into normal life and elements of the normal mixed into the strange?
Partly, but also that's I believed from the very beginning that you can't really do the strange unless you back it with the normal. And if you look at the classic ghost story and horror story writers like M.I. James or Macon or Robert Aikman, they spend a lot of time establishing a reality before they weird it out. Mm. And you have to do that.
You need to anchor it somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's what the notebooks are doing, your fragments of lived life.
That's exactly it. The idea is to shuffle fragments of lived life until they make something very strange, and which hopefully leaves the reader haunted. The haunting is my haunting of the reader, I hope. That would be my aim.
And you said there's a kind of politics attached to it to a certain extent as well. Are you trying to get the reader to, through this haunting experience, to see the world in a new way?
Yeah, or certainly to look at it again. After all, if you can't depend on story, maybe you can't depend on the world either. if you've made a mistake about the story, maybe you're making mistakes about the world. But there's a lot of raw politics in there too, especially in stories like The Crisis, which, as you say, is about a peculiar invasion of the City of London, which might be aliens or it might come from the finance community.
Are they bankers or aliens or both?
Quite. A question we might ask ourselves.
Certainly. This sudden leap into a new way of seeing is a new perspective, if you like, is almost literalised in another one of your fragments, Rockets of the Western Suburbs. Do you want to read a bit of that now?
Rockets of the Western Suburbs. Listen, and it's steady, straight down rain. No wind. A car halts at the corner, pulls away in acknowledgement of its own muffled existence. Tire noise louder than engine noise. And against this, the tendency of things to be. The rims and ribs of terracotta pots, hard and slick with light. Roofs like mirrors. The bricks suck up water. Everything supported by the perfect angle of a drain pipe. This afternoon, Barnes is quiet. This afternoon, every garden plant is one uncanny green or another. The visitors ring the bell, wait in the doorway, too polite to come in immediately, but chatter a lot when they do. They are nice. Their children always have some new practical thing, less a toy than the beginnings of a fruitful lifetime interest. Without warning, an act in itself 100% pure communication, the camera cuts away from this, very fast, upwards, turning in a series of vertical 180-degree snap rolls, so that first you see the world kaleidoscoping rapidly from 1,000 feet up, and then from low orbit. By the time everything's returned to the right scale again, the rain has stopped, and the sun's coming out.
And I realise I misspoke. That's not a bit of it. That's the whole thing. That's the whole fragment. It's grounded in those uncanny greens of Barnes, isn't it? In the detail and the reality of what's going on in West London.
Yeah. What more can you say? You know, the technique is to build that up and then strip it down in as short a time as possible right near the end. And that produces a narrative effect. I wouldn't, in fact, describe these as fragments because they're not fragments of anything. They are themselves. They're not quite flash fiction because they're not. Flash fiction often seems to have traditional narrative to it, which is fine, but it's not really my kind of thing.
What do you call them then? Nuggets, pearls,
I don't know.
Gems?
I have no idea what I'd call them.
I was wanting to ask, who's the you watching the world kaleidoscoping rapidly through the lens of your fiction? Have you got a reader in mind?
No, I often use you now as a way of finally undoing the typical expectations of fiction. One of the expectations of fiction is that there will be a narrator and a narrated about, that often they're the same, they're conflated, and that they're there to position the reader. To me, this you is a kind of condition or state rather than an actual person.
It's the willingness to enter into this strangeness.
Yeah, or it's at the end, it certainly is of the story. At the beginning, it's more of a phenomenological thing. It's a condition of being present.
So when you sit down to write one of your gems, we'll call them, or a longer piece, a short story or a novel, do you have an audience in mind? Are there people you're thinking of reaching with it?
No, I usually have a voice in mind. They're very voice-driven, obviously. They're tone-driven. I mean, in the old days, they would have called them tone poems. But if anybody says that to me, they're dead.
Reeks of Richard Strauss.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. By the same token, they're not poetry either. You know, they're very definitely prosaic. I produced most of them for the blog, and I sort of assumed it would, they would, as it were, be for the audience of the blog, whatever that is. But mainly they're for me in production. As I'm making them, I have an idea and I can't stop writing it down.
Actually, talking of the internet, your reviews on Amazon, there's one of these stories that's been published as a Kindle single, and the reviews on Amazon make for fascinating reading because you've got 5 stars and 1 stars who are almost saying exactly the same thing. They're saying, don't expect answers, says 1 5-star review, do expect surprise and ultimately to be intrigued. But a 1-star says, very odd, nothing really happened, and not quite sure of the purpose. Do you see that bafflement on both sides and think, job done?
Yes, absolutely. I think if you produce 50-50 Amazon or Goodreads reviews like that, you've done your job. Your work here is done and you can go off and have a coffee. I'm proud of the 1-stars in a sense because a lot of them have missed the point so completely that assures me there was a point there to miss.
And it's interesting that it's almost the same reaction but either delight or horror at the same experience,
yeah.
The same reading experience.
Yeah, the horror is also interesting because it does, again, it shows that you have managed to deconstruct the whole of storytelling.
In 3,000 words.
yeah, which is, you know, a goal. That's a goal.
That kind of bafflement is kind of, it's paradoxical when you put the stories together into a collection, because after a while, I suppose, that the even the strangeness starts to feel almost expected. How do you kind of try and make it still uncomfortable?
Well, I don't know. Possibly because this is the most radical collection so far. I have no idea what I would do if I began to suspect that this had become a norm. I think I'd be quite scared, really. This has been the problem with recent politics, hasn't it? You spend all of your life kicking against a stable kind of politics that you hate, and suddenly everything has changed. And your satire and your parodies and your Dylan-esque contempt for a fixed and, as it were, wrong society, all that's out the window. And you wonder what was the norm, and you wonder if, in fact, you operated best against a norm, and that would be true of this. I hope it wouldn't become normative, but I'm 72 anyway, so it's not a problem I'm going to have for a long time.
I mean, I guess also you touch on something that if the idea is to take the world and to give it back strangely, the fact that the world is becoming more strange and more quickly, more dangerous, filled with, I don't know, Donald Trump and even kind of fantasy tropes invading the mainstream, does that make it harder?
Well, that's something I've been thinking about for the last year because I'm in the middle of a novel. I'm always in the middle of the novel. It always seems to be the same novel. It just goes on forever.
And in its various forms.
Yes, in its various forms. But these new politics and the new media landscape, when you say that they're beyond satire or that, you know, parody is over, there's a chill to that. There is I feel a real chill. I feel as if maybe I should reconsider everything that I thought. And I think most of us are trying to do that now. What it will look like the other side, I don't know. I think maybe what it will look like the other side is for another generation.
Is it changing the shape of the novel you're working on now?
I've tried not to let it. I mean, one of the advantages of being heavily metaphoric and of working with the ghost story, the horror story, the science fiction story, is that they have another subject matter. You always have this, as it were, basic subject matter of the horrific or the scientific or whatever. The grounding side of your metaphor is still there and it's still heavy and it has a lot of ballast, and to a degree that is what the reader wants from you. They want their heads knocked out of shape. They want that. They just want it in a slightly more controlled form than they would get it from me. So you can always rely on the fact that you are telling a horror story.
You can ground it over there as
well.
You can
ground it over there, and then if you have to tinker with how you feel the world has changed, then you can do that almost as a subsidiary part. But I wouldn't want to do that for another novel. I would, by the time I start a new novel, I would want to be thinking in the new terms, whatever they are.
There's anger here at the inhumanity of the banking sector, the insanity of the housing market, the inequalities driving migration. But do you think that weird fiction or your strange stories here, do you think that can change how we feel about the real world around us?
Do I? I don't think so, no. I've come after 50 years to the point where I don't think that these forms of fiction, I don't think they do any better at it than any other form of fiction. I think that to the degree that fiction can bring things out into the open, can force discussion, can force reconsideration, can give, as it were, new perspectives, etc., etc., to that degree, yes. But any kind of fiction can do that. I don't think fantasy is especially good at it.
I was meaning it's partly the way that your complexity of meaning, the idea that meaning is difficult and dangerous and something that is actually you have to struggle to apprehend. So it's not necessarily a question about the genre in which any of these stories might be situated. But this kind of difficultness of your work, is that actually more valuable in a space where easy answers are to a penny?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, it would be a massive compliment to think that. The sceptic in me, almost the cynic in me, wonders if that would be the case. I would certainly like to hope that that was the case. Because complexity, really, of thinking and complexity of point of view and the growing complexities of intersectionality, they give a broader and more conclusive view of the world than a narrow, non-complex, simplistic view, obviously.
But the anger there isn't there for any kind of real-world obvious purpose. It's just part of your makeup.
Some of it's part of my makeup. I was hired on New Worlds because I was angry all the time back in the 60s. That was my first job as a kind of books editor was given to me because they knew that I would be angry all the time. And I am. But I think I'm not sure to what degree that's organic and to what degree it's political. It's always been political. And certainly a lot of these stories are more overtly political than by the mid-2000s, by the beginning of the banking crisis, I was political, but I was not as political as I had been. And then suddenly, this whole thing from 2007 onwards switched me back on. And really, most of these stories are a result of that anger and subsequent angers, but, you know, things have not stopped coming along to make you angry. So, yeah, I guess that anger, it's organic, but it's political as well.
One of the things you return to again and again in this collection is the imaginary continent of Autotelia, somewhere in the North Sea. What's the attraction of that particular setting?
In the early 70s, I had the idea to write a novel in which would be written as short stories. It would have been written as 8 or 10 short stories, all with completely different narrators, to completely different points of view, completely separate stories which would be sufficient unto themselves, but which would reveal steadily to the reader that a brand new continent had appeared on the planet, and that, furthermore, everybody on the planet was taking it for granted.
Perfectly ordinary.
Yeah. The only person in the whole exchange who wasn't taking it for granted would be the reader. And by the end, the reader would have got the joke as well. And I tinkered with it for about 2 years until I realised that I was simply not good enough to write it, that technically it was beyond me. Whether it was beyond me at that point or whether it would always be beyond me, I didn't know. But I thought, well, OK, I'll shelve it. And anything I shelve tends to get cannibalised later. So a lot of it got cannibalised into short stories, other novels. And then at around the time of the banking crisis, I began looking at the relics of this project again and suddenly thought, this is ideal. I can use it in a much less technically demanding form. I don't need to write a Dino Buzzati style, you know, Borgesian novel using it. I can just do what I have experienced at, which is building an imaginary country.
Tackle it with a bit more freedom.
Yeah, and use that for political ends. So I did.
Shall we head back there now?
Yeah. Let's go back to the island. Last night, I was in Autotelia again, in the town I have decided to call the provincial capital. In the garden, I found the elephant still chained to the tree where I had left it, its small eye full of knowledge. All the animals seemed amused by their own humiliation. Despite a good night's sleep, despite two or three good nights' sleep on our side of things, I was tired by 8 in the evening. Whatever was happening to me had taken another turn for the worse, but I felt happy, not anxious or afraid or ill, only warm and tired, and now I had got back there, full of the deep eros of the island. Fireflies began to gather in the corner of the summer house, from which, later, the voice I had grown to love would comment on the intimate events of my life in a matter-of-fact whisper. When you write something that short and that suddenly, which that was,
yeah.
What you're after is that elephant to surprise you as much as it surprises the reader. I started the first couple of sentences and then the elephant was there. And I got up and jumped about, going, Mike, why have you done that? Because it was perfect, you know. And the whole of the rest of it pivoted around that experience of having just, wham, produced that sentence. It's such fun to do these things.
Yeah, that moment when it suddenly takes you somewhere else.
Yeah. And me too, you know. It's not just that I can do it for the reader, but it does it for me too, which is actually beyond logic. It shouldn't be able to do that. Anyway, there you go.
There you go indeed. That was M. John Harrison speaking with Richard Lee. Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, is a tale of time and music, as experienced through the stories, among others, of ageing punk rocker-turned-record executive Bernie Salazar and his kleptomaniac assistant Sasha. Her latest, Manhattan Beach, is a very different sort of novel. It charts the American immigrant experience through the Great Depression and the Second World War. When she came to London for a Guardian Live session, Chair John Mullen let the audience do the talking. But he also asked if readers of the novels in their 20s reacted differently to readers in middle age.
The single biggest surprise for me was that anyone under middle age had any interest in this book. Because when I tried to read Proust in my 20s, I love the compulsive love part.
Yes.
But the time part, I thought, what a snore.
Yeah.
That's a really boring topic. Who cares? Well, I felt really differently when I returned to it in my 30s in our book group. It seemed like a very worthwhile topic, possibly the most worthwhile topic. But I thought, okay, well, so this is going to be a book that is really for middle-aged people, and that's okay. I mean, what can I do? But I was amazed to find that even high school kids seemed to like it. And I visited high schools. I mean, that was just incredible to me. I think part of it is the music. So that's something that everyone can relate to. And amazingly enough, people still listen to punk rock. And in fact, you know, because of the kind of continuous present we live in and the fact that everything is available on our devices, in a way, music, I think, doesn't really go out of fashion quite the way it did when I was a kid. Like, the idea of listening to Elvis when I was a teen, are you kidding?
It's all in a permanent present now,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, so that I think in a way that helped me because the music probably felt more valid to young people than it necessarily might have. But I actually think there's one more thing, which is that I think young people now are more aware of the passage of time than I was for one specific reason, which is technology. And that is that although we kind of live in a continuous present, the technology changes constantly and everyone feels old. So when I was teaching undergraduates at NYU, I thought, okay, well, this is good. I need to learn what people, you know, in their very early 20s or late teens are thinking about. What is their relationship to technology? I couldn't believe that we were talking about teenagers, and it was as if I were the same age as the college students, because all of us had a different relationship to technology than the teenagers who were growing up with, say, Facebook, which, of course, this was now several years ago, which the college students I was teaching hadn't grown up with.
So Facebook's all middle-aged people now.
They thought, oh, kids today. And they were kids.
Yes.
So I think that in a way, they were more conscious of time passing than I was, because when I went to college at 19, because I had taken a year off, the only telecommunications development that I was aware of was that a few people had something called the answering machine, which I had not tried yet, but which apparently meant that you didn't have just three options when you made a phone call, of the phone ringing and ringing and ringing, or someone answering or getting a busy signal. And when I told my children that, one of them asked if we had electricity.
I loved reading it again. I'm 28, so I'm one of your 20-year-old readers. I loved reading it this time on Kindle, which I was really surprised by, because I normally use Kindle as like a backup option. And this time I used it on Kindle because I lost my copy. I lent it out and I don't know where it's gone. And it read so well on Kindle because I could do some really lazy like flicking back, seeing which characters have been mentioned before. So I didn't just have to think, how do I know that character? I could look it up really quickly, which was great. When you write, do you think of technology? When you read, do you read on Kindle? What do you think works well?
Well, just one comment about the Kindle. I'm so happy to hear that. When the book came out, the PowerPoint chapter, ironically, worked dismally on the Kindle. It basically didn't work in digital form, if you can believe it. So angry readers were firing emails to me on my public email address, which I later removed, because they were angry that they had to purchase a hardcover book to read the PowerPoint, which understandably irritated them. The answer is I don't think about technology except as a, you know, as a object of contemplation in my work at all as I'm writing. And I'm pretty low tech as a fiction writer because I write mostly by hand. That it's not that I can't use a computer. I mean, as a journalist, I write completely on the computer, but my best ideas as a fiction writer all come from, I think, the unconscious, or whatever you want to call that place that ideas come from that we can't think of. And the only way I can sort of get to that is by writing fast by hand, rather illegibly, and being surprised myself by what happens on the page. None of that happens if I'm using a computer. And so I guess in a way that makes for a really strong break with technology for me in my practice of writing. So I don't think about it. And it's certainly, I mean, I wondered about printing the PowerPoint. I thought, gosh, it's going to be expensive. I had worries like that, which is a little unusual for me. And I thought, well, if they just use a URL address, so be it. That chapter will be only available online. But beyond that, generally, I don't think too much about technology or I think about the experience of the reader, for sure, but not the technological experience. And I also really feel like reading is reading. I have no judgments. I love audiobooks. I think I remember books better if I listen to them than if I read them. So I couldn't care less how people read. I'm just happy when they do.
Hi. This is such a sharp group of characters, and I'm sure that everyone has different characters who really stand out for them. And I wondered for you, who or which characters really bled beyond the borders of the book, or have any haunted you for longer than the stories?
Well, I really want to write another book related to this one. I mean, part of it is I'm still galled by the things that didn't work. I think epic poetry I'm going to let go. I'm not going to try that again. But there were, I don't even think it's not really about Rolf. Like I think some of those people I won't want to write about anymore. But I've already written one novella about a character from Goon Squad. It's called Black Box, and I wrote it for Twitter, and that's about Lulu. So I feel like the open-ended nature of it kind of invites me to dip back in. I would hope that I could, first of all, nothing about time and nothing about music. So therefore, it would have to be, it would only be acceptable to me if using some of the same organizational principles, I could arrive at a book with a very different set of queries and fixations. But I do love the thought of doing that, and there are a number of characters I'm interested in pursuing, but they might be people that you might not even recognize if I said their names, because they're really quite peripheral. But I'm very interested in Bix, who's a technology whiz from the chapter called Out of Body. Let's see, who else do I want to write? I'm interested in Noreen, the crazy next-door neighbor.
Who sits by the fence, yes.
Yes, I'm interested
yes,
in her.
Yes, I was thinking, what's that all about? Yes, well, you're going to tell us.
I hope so, I hope so. If I can do it well, which is a big if. Let's see. I'm interested in Lincoln, Sasha's son. Very interested in him, because we do so much looking at him from the outside. So those, I'm interested in Ted, Sasha's uncle, although I wouldn't write from his point of view again, but I am curious about, as you said, there's this kind of tumbling into his future. I actually tried to write about him again, and that didn't work.
Right.
So we'll see. I'm interested in people that are sort of barely there in this book, but somehow swooping into a world in which they're front and center. And I think I'm going to have to write it in the future again. There's no other way to do it if they're young. So that presents its own set of challenges.
And what was it like writing Black Box? I also wanted to ask about that because it was so succinct.
I was thrilled writing that book, that whatever it is, a novella. It was much longer initially. Yeah, that was really an exciting process. It was in some ways similar to or analogous to the PowerPoint. I kind of started with Twitter and tried to find a story that demanded to be told in those small structural units, and then that question, that desire to find a story like that sort of coalesced with other things that I had been thinking about, and I just kind of followed it into that piece.
I was quite surprised to see Manhattan Beach described as your first historical fiction, given Goon Squad and Invisible Circus both have historical settings, but the publisher really wanted to play that aspect up. I just wonder if you could say something about your relationship to research and that genre, historical fiction.
Well, I don't know if I would call Goon Squad historical because I guess the earliest chapter takes place in 73 and I was, you know, perceiving human at that point. So to me, this one is interested in time, but not really historical. It's true that The Invisible Circus, it's not set before my lifetime, but I did definitely have to do some historical research. Particularly into, you know, pacifist student groups that turned and kind of calcified into violence. But the quantity and the degree of research I had to do for Manhattan Beach is pretty much, it's such a difference of degree that it almost becomes a difference of kind. And for me, writing entirely outside my lifetime was extremely challenging because the only things that I actually use from my life ever in these books are times and places that I know. So for example, in Goon Squad, the punk rock scene of the 70s, which I witnessed very much as a kind of wallflower, you know, observer, but still I was kind of physically present. And all kinds of other moments, you know, that moment in New York when some people were online and some weren't, the kind of mystery that which combined with sort of the grunge moment and music, you know, these were all times and places that I remembered. So for me to move outside of that was extremely difficult. And not only that, but there's a lot of very technical stuff in Manhattan Beach about deep sea diving and the Brooklyn Navy Yard and merchant sailing during the war. So I think it is fair to call it a historical novel versus these others. The only bummer is some people are not interested in historical novels, so that's always the danger of a title. But I have learned that you know, being uncategorizable, which is what I went for with Goon Squad, has its pitfalls too. So I guess I've learned to just sort of trust the marketing people to know how to find the readers that will like the book.
Could you talk about how you were doing Manhattan Beach and then all of a sudden Goon Squad sort of usurped the place as the book you were working on and the book that came next?
Well, I started researching Manhattan Beach and was interested in the time and place, which is, again, all I start with, of New York during the Second World War. and before, in around 2005. And I researched in a pretty desultory, experiential way until, while I was writing other books, first The Keep and then A Visit from the Goon Squad. And then I began writing Manhattan Beach in 2012. So there was no putting aside of any written text to write Goon Squad. There was simply procrastinating about getting started on writing this historical novel, or whatever it is. And I think the reason I was procrastinating was, I think I probably sensed how unbelievably hard it was going to be for me to do it and to make it work. And you know, there were various reasons. I mean, our kids were still young. I think I was just very hesitant. I also do think that Goon Squad was very informed by the research I had already been doing for Manhattan Beach. I gave you one very concrete example about the future leaps coming out of those letters, but also, you know, starting in about 2005, I was interviewing a lot of people toward the ends of their lives, people in their 80s, who either had lived in New York, had been born in New York and remembered their childhoods really clearly, and also men and women who had worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard during the war. And just that experience of talking to people at the end of their lives about the beginning of their lives just inevitably, I think, synced up with my curiosity about writing a book about time, explicitly about time. So I think in a way, there are actually quite a few points of connection between Goon Squad and Manhattan Beach, more than meet the eye. The other thing I think is just that Manhattan Beach, like Goon Squad, partakes of a number of different genres. Even though they're not divided out by chapters, I was thinking a lot about the noir very explicitly, both from movies and detective fiction. Sea survival stories, which are really a genre unto themselves, sort of like murder mysteries in a way. The stakes are always high because survival is always on the table as a question. And also trying to combine all of that with a certain domestic component, neither of which really suggest domesticity. So there was this feeling of wanting to force incompatible realms into conjunction and see if they could have additional power through their proximity to each other, as opposed to just contradict each other.
I wanted to ask a bit of a technical question. Your prose is really very, very virtuosistic, but at the same time, it is not gimmicky. So when you take the PowerPoint chapter, there's a reason there. I see, for example, as a child who doesn't speak, like trying to narrate something, or the second person chapter, which is talking about a young man who is homosexual, but is somehow repressed, and there's this distance. So there's always like a reason for those tools. I was going to ask you about that process because I thought it was very deliberate, but from this conversation, it's not clear to me anymore if it is that deliberate. So how does it come about to you?
You know, it is both deliberate and sort of instinctive. I think the deliberation comes first in setting up ideal circumstances for my instincts to work. So, for example, I mean, sometimes I just start writing from a time and a place, and certain technical choices become clear. Like, I rarely have to wonder, should this be first person or third person, for example. But then there were these cases with Goon Squad where I started with a genre. Like, second person is a perfect example. I thought, I'd love to use the second person. It so rarely works. And I didn't spend too much time analyzing why it doesn't, but you just basically pointed to it, which is that it's basically first person from the point of view of someone who is alienated from themselves, in some way estranged from their own inner lives. Yes. And one thing that I especially was interested in second person, because as a journalist, and you may start to notice this, people use it conversationally all the time. Yeah. And they tend to use it when they are talking about something that is too close to themselves for comfort. And as a journalist, one hates this. I wanted to say, you hate it. because those are not great quotes. It's not ideal when someone speaks in the second person. It feels removed. And so I was curious about that. I'm vividly aware of how often it comes into play in conversation as a journalist, where I'm always trying to get people to avoid it. And yet it so rarely works in fiction. But so all of that sounds kind of deliberate. But the solution to the problem, at least the initial solution, is instinctive. So I didn't think, oh, okay, gee, well, I have to find a guy who's kind of alienated from himself. Why would someone be alienated? I mean, you could arrive at all the same decisions in that way, but that's not how it works for me. So I just started writing and realized as I went, basically in the moment that he starts recounting his homosexual encounter, which was actually an anecdote that I heard when I was writing a story about closeted Marines during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the U.S. Back in the 90s. This very powerful story about these two guys going on dates and then having the dates leave the car. And it was just, it was so poignant. And then the agony that they didn't speak to each other again after that. So that just kind of appeared. And in a way, it may be that the second person led me to it because I was already dealing with this kind of estrangement. And then in the discovery process of writing that first draft was about understanding why the estrangement exists.
It's a really interesting question, isn't it? That sort of thought that there might be a contradiction between a writer doing things instinctually and actually also having reasons for doing it, rather than the two actually maybe going together. Or the reasons are the things the reader or the critic finds.
Yeah, I think I should mention, because I have a tendency to not mention that I have to do endless revision. Sometimes I make it sound like I just get inspired and sort of speak in tongues and it all works. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, these first drafts are a catastrophe. I mean, the first draft of Manhattan Beach was 1,400 handwritten pages. I didn't even remember people's names. I had to change names through the book because I couldn't find the earlier point when I had written about them and didn't remember what I had named them. So it's a big, huge mess. And then the deliberate part of me, the analytical part, comes up with very, very detailed outlines to try to use the good that has come of this, hopefully some moves that make sense, and shape them into material that will really work. And that shaping is essential. I mean, without that, it's just a huge mess.
Thank you. I find myself thinking about the final chapter probably several times a week, particularly that idea of, and it maybe sounds a bit weird, but I mean,
I'll
explain a bit, the idea of people being immune to advertising, this world where people basically all they have is their sort of reputation and their social capital and then being willing to sort of sell that or not. And it just seems to me, unlike a lot of sort of attempts to write about technological developments in the future, which then seem a bit weird a bit later on, it seems to be incredibly prescient. And I just wonder if you could talk a bit about how you sort of imagine that world and how you think about it now in an era of fake news and other things.
Well, I mean, first of all, I should say I entered the future very reluctantly. I did not want to do it. But I really wanted to write about Alex in his later life. The kind of structural ideas of the book seem to almost demand that. I mean, we start with him. He's a minor character. What happens to him? He's kind of full of attitude and clearly new to New York and very young. But I was so reluctant to go into the future that I actually considered trying to move the timeline of the entire book back so that I could arrive with Alex in something like the present, which already now is the past. And basically, the bottom line of why I didn't do that was that it essentially brought me back to Elvis. I lost punk rock. I mean, there was no way. So I had to let that go. So I guess I imagined forward following various clues that I had seen. That particular idea of the parrots, I think, came from an article I read years ago about the music producer, whose name I think is Rick Rubin. I'm not sure if I have that right. Anyway, he was talking about some ideas he had for the future of the music industry, trying to, you know, once again, someone trying to figure out kind of how to salvage the industry. And he talked about wanting to have, you know, influential people working to, you know, kind of popularize ideas and groups. And I thought, but wait a minute, what do you mean? You're going to pay them to do that? And then how much capital will they really, how much will their opinion mean if people know that it's paid. And so I just kind of ran with that imaginatively and came up with what I came up with, which all of which I think now has clearly come true. I mean, I know there's all kinds of stuff about bloggers and, you know, like people who blog about products they like. And of course, it's, you know, inevitable that various, you know, manufacturers would like them to blog about their products. I think it's often just following logic. You know, logic has its own energy. And Jane Smiley, actually, I didn't think that up, but she talked about following the energy of sheer logic into various scenarios. And not surprisingly, if it really is logic, you know, actual events, at least some of them, are likely to go the same way. All of the ideas in Goon Squad are now outdated. I mean, I would never write the chapter the way I did. It's all over. I mean, there were no iPhones yet when I was writing that chapter. You know, Hurricane Sandy hadn't come. I mean, now there is actually talk of building a wall right. In Lower Manhattan, which was inundated. So those ideas were barely ahead, and now they're behind. You know, I'm responding to the same set of ideas and factors that we all are. And so I guess sometimes I'm sort of moving in tandem with reality, and once in a while I get a little bit ahead, but then it overtakes me shortly.
You've written, I think, 3 novels and a collection of short stories before A Visit from the Goon Squad came out. And I suppose I was wondering why you think this book was so much bigger than your previously sort of published works.
That's a very good question. I never would have expected that. I think the answer is luck. It's a lot of this stuff is luck. You know, I think for some reason, I mean, as I said, I thought it was a book for middle-aged people about time passing. I did not have big hopes in the marketplace. And initially, it tanked, as I said, you know, partly because no one knew what it was. But I think there was some way in which people felt that it was relevant to their moment. One thing that I hadn't expected was that some people felt that the way I moved from character to character, or sort of curiosity element to curiosity element, let's say, mimicked online experience. That was not in my head, but it may have partly been why that idea seemed exciting to me, this sort of, you know, zooming in and out. But I think really it is just luck. Sometimes you just happen to come up with something that feels relevant at a particular moment, and it happened with this.
That was Jennifer Egan speaking with John Mullen at a Guardian Book Club event in London. A Visit from the Goon Squad is published by Corsair in the UK and Anchor in the US, and Manhattan Beach is published also by Corsair in the UK, but by Scribner in the US. M. John Harrison's You Should Come With Me Now is published by Comma Press. Next week, we're joined by the physicist and artificial intelligence campaigner Max Tegmark and the science fiction novelist Ken MacLeod for an exploration of why artificial intelligence could be a more urgent issue even than climate change, and what it might feel like to live in a world where human intelligence has been surpassed by that of our own technology. Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development, and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. You can also find us there as well, of course. Just open up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. And you can get in touch with us via bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.